ICE raids on Greyhound buses, Florida gives a $500 million in tax cuts to corporations, and Venezuelan dancers find refuge at a ballet school in Miami. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Immigration enforcement is now looking at Greyhound buses to detain people. But what are the laws when it comes to searching transportation hubs? We'll look at that and an update on the Homestead Childhood Detention Facility that now sits empty. What happened to those children? Also, a few of Florida's biggest corporations are getting massive tax refunds. Did Florida lawmakers lose out on money that they could have used for other services? And finally,
my family, that it's still there. Some days they cannot eat. It's really bad, actually. It's bad.
We'll hear the story of a young Venezuelan dancer who escaped her home country. She found refuge in a local ballet school. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. Well, in recent weeks, Customs and Border Patrol agents in Broward and Miami-Dade counties have been visiting Greyhound bus terminals asking riders, show the immigration papers. Now, this is a practice that has ramped up recently as part of President Trump's immigration strategy. The Miami Herald's Monique Madden has the story and an update also on the Homestead Childhood Detention Facility. That's a story that she's been covering for quite some time. She joins us now from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. Monique, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this story about ICE agents going on to the Greyhound buses checking immigration status of some of the passengers. Where's that happening?
Sure. So we've gotten reports of sightings in Miami and Fort Lauderdale, but honestly and technically, it could be happening anywhere in Florida at any Greyhound bus station. The law allows CBP to make a warrantless arrest within a, quote, reasonable distance, which is basically defined as any location as far as 100 air miles from the coastal border, which is everywhere if you look at a map.
Are you getting tips from people, from people who have been approached by ICE or even by Greyhound?
Well, it's not ICE. It's Customs and Border Patrol. And I do want to make that distinction. ICE does not make targeted enforcement efforts, as they have said in the past. They don't go to public places and just do this type of stuff. But CBP can. And you're asking me if they have the right to do that?
No. Where you're getting the information? It's like, who's telling you?
Absolutely. Yeah. Immigration attorneys have given me a call.
I gotcha.
If you look at social media, it's all over the place, as well as people calling the Miami Herald and saying, hey, I saw CBP officials at the stations.
You know, I recall this story. It's not new. I recall, CPB doing these kind of things on Greyhound buses when I was living in Las Vegas. This is under the Obama administration. There were Greyhounds going to the border, but are agents targeting specific buses or routes? Do we know that?
Not that we're aware of. Border Patrol did tell me that they are ramping up their transportation checks in direct support of border enforcement efforts, but we do not know if they're targeting any specific routes.
Do we know what's happening to folks? I mean, if agents are picking up people on the buses and taking them off, are they detaining them there?
Yes, so they do detain them there, and then they're processed, and they're temporarily held in CBP custody before being transferred to ICE.
Remind us of the law. You kind of touched on it a second ago. Officials can enter a vehicle or some form of transportation within a specific distance of the border if they have probable cause, which makes it tricky in Florida because that's almost anywhere in Florida.
Yes, so CBP agents, according to federal law, don't need a warrant to, quote, apprehend someone within a reasonable distance from an external boundary of the U.S., basically to board and search for any undocumented individuals in any vessel within the territorial waters of the U.S., in any rail car, aircraft, conveyance, or vehicle. And that's where they say, okay, we have the right to do this. However, I do want to say this, Luis, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, disputes that Greyhound is required to comply with this, and they've cited a Supreme Court ruling that says that they believe it quashes that law, and it says that there must be probable cause to enter any vessel or vehicle.
What have Greyhound officials said about this?
Well, they are not commenting on their rebuttal, on the ACLU's rebuttal, but they have told me that Greyhound is required to comply with the requests of federal agents. They said that they have passed out Know Your Rights pamphlets at their terminals. They've posted it on their websites. They've also acknowledged that the searches have negatively impacted their customers and their business. But again, they're not responding to any questions regarding the ACLU's stance on this.
And the other thing, too, is that, you know, from your story as well, but also stories I've heard over the past years, that you have folks, again, who don't have their green card. They don't have the papers. So they're worried about travel because, you know, example, taking an airplane, you're going to have to go through security and then people will know. And Greyhound was considered maybe the safe route. But have you heard from any groups as to now there's just a fear of any form of transportation or transportation hub that you want to avoid because, well, there's a possibility that perhaps CBP officials might be there?
Absolutely. I've spoken to countless of attorneys who have said that they've always, for many years, have advised their clients not to take Greyhound buses. This is according to the attorneys. They believe that Greyhound buses seem to be a more popular route. They're more mainstream. They have a lot of connections and routes across the entire country. So they believe it's a hot spot for CBP. But technically, Louis, CBP could board a public bus, a city bus. They do have that ability as well. So the answer is yes.
And I take it maybe trains also might be out.
Absolutely.
Anything like that. Mm-hmm. You talked about, you know, because we mentioned it before on the program, we've talked with you about this, you know your rights. But a lot of times that's when you maybe be at home and you don't have to open the door to anybody. But when you're on a bus like that, what are your rights?
Well, you don't have to answer. And that's tricky. And I'd rather not go into that right now because it's a really long explanation. I do encourage people to look it up on our website because I do link to it in my story.
I wanted to ask you about some Florida law enforcement agencies, I should say, and departments in the state have undergone this CBP training in helping detain immigrants. Have any South Florida law enforcement agencies signed up for this?
No, at least not yet. The answer is no.
And how does that work exactly? I mean, are we turning law enforcement into basically CBP agents?
Well, it's tricky. So this allows ICE to deputize officers, which gives them the ability to arrest and detain undocumented immigrants. The agreement's called the Warrant Service Officers Program, and it was introduced in May as a way for local cops to more easily comply with a controversial state law that was passed in May. So basically, supporters of the agreement say that it's aimed at addressing a federal court ruling that found jailers could not detain inmates to face potential deportation simply because of a federal request. But what this does, when we spoke to the Pinellas County Sheriff, said that what this does is that it allows authorized jailers to hold inmates up to 48 hours without a court-ordered immigration detainer. And this is important. The Pinellas County Sheriff said that in order for you to be impacted by this, you would have had to commit a crime.
I'm talking with the Miami Herald's Monique Madden. Customs and Border Patrol agents have been spotted at Greyhound bus terminals in Miami-Dade and Broward counties. Again, this, across the country. You can find more on this reporting at WLRN Sundahl on our Facebook or Twitter pages. Monique, you've also, and I want to switch over now to the Homestead Detention Facility. You reported extensively on this. Again, they held, over a period of time, thousands of migrant minors. And then, within a few weeks, the kids are gone. And I'm wondering, first of all, how long and how many transfers did it take to empty the place out and get all the kids out?
Well, let's just put it this way. During the week of July 3rd, they had roughly 2,700 kids to 3,000 kids. And then on August 1st, which is about 4 weeks later, it was at zero. And the 200-plus kids were transferred out that day. It's unknown how many transfers it took to empty out the place, but there were at least a dozen or several dozens, I feel comfortable saying. They were expediting that process little by little, and therefore it could have been many, many, many transfers.
It just seemed such a quiet thing how they were able to just move them out, knowing that there have been so many protests there and so many eyes on that place. But again, quietly, they were successful in just removing the kids.
Yes, and we've gotten reports of the buses leaving in the middle of the night, and it's, you know, I've spoken to my sources there, and the reason why they do that is because of that. They don't want eyes on them, and they feel that it's for the safety of the children.
Why were the kids moved out of this facility?
Well, for starters, hurricane season is here in South Florida, and they felt that once there was a storm on the map and we had seen a tropical wave nearby, that's immediately when their evacuation plan was triggered, and they immediately made the efforts of starting to transfer out all of these kids, which drew a lot of scrutiny because a lot of lawmakers believe that they could have been doing that from the beginning.
Do we know where all these kids went?
All we know is that the majority of the last group of kids that were there were taken to other shelters, mainly because they didn't have any sponsors. But the bulk of the others were united with a sponsor, and that's according to federal officials.
Something you pointed out in your reporting is this facility employed a lot of people.
Yes, about 4,400 people, to be exact. They were all working there. It's a big operation.
So what happened to them? Where do they go?
Well, at the beginning, when, you know, most of them were actually going to be laid off, and with only 130 employees slated to stay. But then sources told me that those plans changed and that about 2,500 employees will keep their jobs in order to have at least 1,200 beds ready in case kids come back to the property at some point.
Have you heard anything from immigration attorneys who have been trying to work to help these kids? Have you any of them come forward to tell what's happening now?
They are also in the dark. They're waiting and they're waiting. They feel that they don't know a lot that's going on. They're still waiting for word from the federal government on whether or not they're going to stay there, whether how many staffers they're going to need to be on call and all that sort of stuff. So they're in the dark too.
So am I getting this right that facility may at some point reopen?
Absolutely.
What's it being used for now? It's just sitting there?
Well, yeah, right now there are no kids, but there are a ton of employees. And from the outside, it looks pretty busy during their shift changes at about 7 a.m. and 3 p.m. But what they're doing inside is unclear. Although, Louis, I have to say, some employees have told me that they're killing time by playing board games, dominoes, basketball, and some group exercise.
You know, the other thing, too, is the fact that, I mean, this is a privately owned operation, correct?
Yes.
When it comes to that, I mean, if a place isn't if it's not being used, then is it losing money or is it getting its money from the government?
We're currently working on that, on figuring all those logistics out.
And then just to finish up with this is, have you heard from lawmakers? Because obviously we had a lot, not just the presidential candidates that were coming through town, but, you know, a lot of lawmakers here locally were very vocal about what was going on at the facility since the children were removed. Have you heard from any local lawmakers, county or city officials, about what's happened?
Well, there is an effort to help those people that are losing their jobs, and they're doing efforts with the county on some job fairs and stuff like that. But as far as I have heard from members of Congress who are upset that this operation might be reopened, some of them have held press conferences outside the shelters since we broke the news last week. So it's going.
Again, talking with the Miami Herald's Monique Madden, discussing the future of the Homestead Childhood Detention Facility. It's empty now. She also spoke to us earlier about the Customs and Border Patrol agents now targeting Greyhound bus terminals. As she pointed out, by the way, if you want to know more about your rights in any situation, they do have it on their website. We'll also be sharing that on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Monique, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And again, she was joining us from the WLRN studios at the Miami Herald in Doral. Well, still to come, why are some of Florida's biggest corporations getting a tax refund in the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars? That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, more than $500 million in tax refunds is expected to go to some of Florida's largest corporations. For context, that's five times more than the additional funds for school safety and 10 times more than the state spent on fighting the opioid crisis. The refunds are in part because of the major changes made in federal tax law by the Trump administration back in 2018. But reporting by Jason Garcia from the Sun Sentinel found lobbying by some of Florida's largest corporations in Tallahassee led to changes on the state level that allowed for such massive refunds. He joins us now from the studios of WMFE in Orlando. Always a great pleasure. Thank you, Mr. Garcia.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This was an issue that was barely discussed during the legislative session. Were watchdog groups and reporters surprised to find that such a high number was being paid back to, again, really a small group of very big companies?
Yeah, that's right. I think a lot of people were surprised. A lot of that has to do with the way this was handled. They committed to the tax cut before they had any idea how much it would cost. So when the legislation passed, it was very obscure. It was very hard to sort of understand. And there were no dollar figures attached to it because they didn't know how much it would cost. So nobody really realized at the time, it seems, what a significant amount of money we were talking about.
We have to look back at President Trump's tax plan that was put in place in 2018. Briefly describe how those changes affected corporate taxes around the country.
Yeah, so speaking specifically to corporate income taxes, it did a couple of things. First of all, it cut the overall tax rate by about 40%. It also enacted a massive tax break known as bonus depreciation, 100% bonus depreciation, where when a company makes a capital investment, they can write off the full value of that immediately. But it was also tax reform, so it eliminated or scaled back a number of deductions and other tax breaks in the tax code. The idea is you sort of broaden the base but lower the rate. And so the overall effect was a major tax cut for corporations on the federal level, but it had the effect of broadening the amount of profits that are subject to tax. And that affects your state taxes because Florida's corporate income tax regime is based off of the federal government's definition of what's taxable income. So whatever the federal government says is taxable income, Florida then takes up taxes a percentage of that. So when the federal government expanded that base, that meant Florida was taxing a larger base as well.
And then after this, you had companies that went to Tallahassee lobbying for their opportunity.
Yeah, that's right. So as soon as the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act passed in Washington, business lobbyists fanned out to state capitals around the country and started lobbying them, saying that they were going to face a giant state income tax increase. They were sort of not mentioning that they were getting an enormous federal income tax cut as part of this. So basically, they were saving a lot of money on their federal income taxes and giving some of that back on their state income taxes. But that was a really effective message, especially in Republican-controlled legislatures where, philosophically, Republican legislators are generally inclined to support any kind of tax cut.
Tell us about some of these companies. Which ones were they?
So in our reporting, the one thing to know about Florida's corporate income tax is that almost nobody pays it. It's 1% of the 2.3 million businesses in Florida actually pay corporate income tax, and they're the biggest businesses out there. And our between lobbying disclosure records, internal emails, and other documents we found, the companies we saw lobbying for this included Disney, Anheuser-Busch, Avis Budget Group, Comcast, Pfizer, Ford. So the very largest of the largest companies out there.
I'm wondering, how does that help companies like a Disney or Anheuser-Busch that have these large physical operations as part of their business model? How is it helping them?
Well, it's saving them a lot of money, right? So it's $540 million is getting refunded back to these companies, and they'll each get their share. And it's heavily concentrated even within that 1% of companies towards the top. So I believe the stat is the top 500 taxpayers in Florida pay roughly 60% of the corporate income tax. So about 60% of these refunds will go to those 500 companies.
So one of the key players in all of this is Republican State Senator Paul Renner. What was his initial argument about why the Florida legislature would support these changes?
Well, the argument from the beginning, and I think the Republican legislators that I spoke to about this will say they wanted to avoid a tax increase. As far as they're concerned, it doesn't matter what happened on to companies. It doesn't matter that companies are saving a lot on their federal income taxes. They're focused in solely on state income taxes, and they didn't want to collect more state income taxes from companies. So they said they needed that they did not want to have a tax increase. When it came time to pass, though, because they had committed to this before actually knowing the amount, there was a lot of prediction that this wouldn't be very much. So they said, I think Representative Renner said he said on the House floor that it was likely to be an insubstantial amount of money. And what he says is that they were surprised at how big the number was. He says that they picked a cap of 7% because that's sort of historically what the tax range is, and it ended up jumping almost 30%.
So lawmakers and state economists, they didn't know how much money this would add up to.
No, and yet they committed to the tax cut anyway without knowing that. And the argument you get there is they didn't want a tax increase, so ultimately the size of the tax cut doesn't matter to them.
Why is it difficult to predict ahead of time how much money companies are going to save as a result of these kind of tax changes?
Well, there's a few reasons. One, the Tax Cut and Jobs Act had just gone into effect, so there was no data that anyone sort of on the government side of things could be looking at this point, or very little anyway. And the other thing is all corporate income tax information is confidential, right? The one group of people that had some knowledge of this stuff would have been the companies themselves. They've got large, sophisticated accounting departments who would have been modeling the impact of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act all the way through as Congress was lobbying for it. So they would have had some idea of the amounts of money we might be talking here, but obviously they weren't volunteering information about that.
I'm talking with Jason Garcia, reporter with the Orlando Sentinel. Garcia's latest piece looks into the $560 million in tax refunds that major companies in Florida are expected to receive as a result of changes in federal tax law and lobbying, of course, in the state legislature. And he joins us from the studios of WMFE in Orlando. Jason, why are Florida's largest companies the only ones that are benefiting from these changes? Why not some of the smaller companies?
Because these refunds go exactly to who pays the corporate income tax. So in Florida, in 2017, the most recent year we have available, there's only about 22,300 companies that paid any corporate income tax at all. And the reason for that is sort of twofold. The legislature has passed laws that exempt entire classes of company entirely from the tax, and they've also passed laws that allow companies that do pay the tax to use strategies like paying themselves for the right to use their own name or assigning their sales outside of Florida to use these strategies that have the effect of reducing their taxable income to zero. So it's a combination of laws that exempt companies and laws that allow companies to use strategies that reduce their taxable income.
Have you heard anything from the Small Business Administration or other watchdog groups? Do they have any issues?
Yeah, I think there are a number of groups that would like to have seen the legislature do something else with this money. Just to give you one example, the legislature pulled $125 million out of affordable housing programs this year to spend on other things because they said they needed the money for other uses. There are a number of groups that advocate against corporate income tax cuts that would have preferred to have seen the money put into affordable housing in Miami and Orlando and Tampa and other places where that's a challenge. Some of the lawmakers who have supported this have suggested maybe they could look to do something different in the future. So Representative Renner said rather than making any sort of permanent corporate income tax reductions, he might prefer to see the legislature use that savings to instead reduce a tax paid by a larger number of taxpayers. He singled out the sales tax Florida charges on commercial lease payments. So that is a policy choice the legislature could make. They haven't done that yet, so that could be something to watch for in the future.
So do we expect any lawmakers possibly to switch on this in the 2020 session and maybe adapt Florida's tax law to funnel more money into the state to change the course on this, perhaps?
It's possible. I would be shocked if the legislature, which is pretty solidly in Republican control, would go back on this. Representative Renner suggested the legislature has by no means tied its own hands because one thing they did this past session is, again, before knowing how much any of this stuff was going to cost, they committed to two more years worth of refunds under this stuff. Representative Renner suggested the legislature could change its mind about that and try and do something else. It is possible. I wouldn't be surprised if there's some discussion about that this year, particularly from Democrats who were opposed to these tax cuts to begin with. But I would be very surprised if anything changing what has already passed happens.
Do we have any idea if any Florida lawmakers have gotten any campaign contributions from these larger companies? Just wondering if there's a conflict.
Well, yeah, I mean, these companies are some of the biggest contributors in all of Florida politics, right? So the Walt Disney Company spent about $28 million on state elections in Florida during the 2018 cycle. There would be very few legislators in all of Florida that haven't gotten money from Disney, for instance, in their campaign accounts. You know, the response you will get when you ask legislators about that is that the money doesn't buy their votes, right? That these companies are buying into them because they support their philosophy. You know, and it's legal. The way the Florida campaign finance law is written, that these companies can make these donations and legislators can have political committees that can accept unlimited contributions from these companies.
And Representative Renners is next in line for Speaker of the House, right, in 2022. Does that indicate anything about the future of corporate tax law, do you think?
Yeah, he's number two in line. So So the next speaker in 2020 will be a guy out of Tampa. And then in 2022, Paul Renner will take over. What that gives him a significant amount of power in the Florida legislature, and it will continue to increase over the next few years. So if he is serious about, you know, preferring to use this money to reduce a different tax, he will have the leverage to at least make that a significant discussion in the legislature.
You know, we know under Governor Rick Scott, you know, he was very big on getting around the country and, you know, encouraging and enticing companies, big companies, to come to Florida, to move to Florida. But give us a sense of just how friendly Tallahassee is to large corporations.
Oh, I think incredibly friendly. Two of the state's main big business lobbying groups, the Florida Chamber of Commerce and Associated Industries of Florida, will issue report cards every session, and the overwhelming number of legislators in Florida do very well on those report cards. I think the larger businesses are the most influential lobby in Tallahassee.
And what have we heard from Governor DeSantis on this?
Well, Governor DeSantis hasn't weighed in on this directly, but he did sign the law this year extending the refunds for the next 2 years. So he's on record as supporting further corporate tax refunds.
And the final numbers on this should be out in September. What's next in your reporting on this?
So September 1st is when economists will certify the final dollar amount. And then in October 1st, another piece of this is, in addition to sending out these refunds, the law also calls for the corporate tax rate, which is normally 5.5%, will be reduced proportionately. So as of October 1st, the Florida Department of Revenue will set the new corporate tax rate. Economists have preliminarily looked at that and already expect that to save big corporations another $560 million in the tax year we're now in, or the fiscal year we're now in. So that's probably the next step, is certifying the total amounts of the refunds and then figuring out what the tax rate is going to be.
So, you know, I just come back to what you said earlier is, you know, again, this idea that, is there all this money that was there on the table that we could have used for, again, school safety, just education in general, or, you know, any of these other services? Is that what really happening here? Is that that's a lot of money that we could have been using otherwise?
Sure. Yeah, that's the policy choice every time you make a tax cut, right? If they hadn't done this, there would be, you know, $540 million more that they could choose to spend. They could choose to cut a different tax. They could choose to spend it on anything that you mentioned. None of these decisions happen in a vacuum, right? You don't, when you cut a tax, that there's an opportunity cost there, and whether that's cutting a different tax or spending it on a different program. But yeah, they obviously could have chosen not to give these refunds and spend the money on something else.
And as you said, you know, it's the biggest companies, the bigger companies that are going to be getting the refund, because there is the belief that if we're giving them those refunds, then they're going to be able to create more jobs or create better opportunities for the state. That's the thinking, right?
Yeah, that's one of the central underpinnings behind this sort of thing, that you give the money back to job creators who will then spend that money expanding their own businesses, creating new job opportunities.
Again, talking with Jason Garcia, the Orlando Sentinel's reporter, joining us from the studios of WMFE in Orlando. You can find Jason's reporting on this tax refund that Florida's major corporations are going to be getting by finding it on our social media. Just look up Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Jason, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, still to come, we're going to meet an 18-year-old Venezuelan ballet dancer who is waiting for TPS for her and her family. Meanwhile, she's trying to get her education, and she's got a lot of stress with all of this. We're going to find out more of her story coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, made a desperate plea on Sunday. More aid is needed for Venezuelan refugees. He said, quote, "This is really one of the most underfunded humanitarian appeals in the world for one of the biggest crises," end quote. The refugee crisis hits very close to home in Miami, especially for 18-year-old ballet dancer Mylin Rodriguez. Mylin escaped Venezuela with her family 3 years ago. Because of ballet connections between Venezuela and South Florida, she received a scholarship to continue dancing with the Arts Ballet Theater of Florida in North Miami Beach. Ruby Romero Isayev is the executive director of the Arts Ballet Theater. She and her husband also came to the U.S. from Venezuela over 20 years ago. Now, we spoke with Mylin and Ruby last week about the challenges that dancers face when they come to the U.S. and the prospect of reuniting with families. Mylin, I want to start with you. Tell me about when you started to see your friends leave Venezuela. You told me there were goodbye parties that you started to attend.
Yes. Probably 2 years, maybe 3 years before I came in. I had one of my best friends. She had to move. She actually is here in the United States. I think she was, like, the first one that I noticed that, you know, something is going on, like, people are leaving, that, like, this is actually happening. There was, like, a lot of feelings at the moment because they were leaving, but at the same time, I couldn't understand because I was like, we can still stay here, you know, it's not that bad at the moment. But 2 years later, it was, like, for 1 month, I had, like, at least two or three goodbye parties. Everyone was leaving like in the matter of like a month or two. It was crazy. Like my class, it was about 30 students at the moment. And when I left, there was only 17.
Tell me when you and your family decided it's time for you to get out.
That was a decision that we made in 1 week, actually.
1 week?
Yes.
Okay. What happened? How did that go?
We had like a bad experience. And after that, my dad just said everyone down in the table and we said, listen, we cannot stay here anymore. We have to figure it out. What are we going to do? And what I said was, if you want us out of the country, that has to be in this month. Because if you let me start school right now, it's my last year. I'm not gonna leave. Like, it's going to be even worse for me. So my mom just kind of like called some people and started to like get info. And 3 days, my mom was like, okay, we had the tickets. We're leaving next Monday. And that was it.
And the tickets were for here in Miami.
Yes.
Ruby, you hear stories like this.
Yeah, a lot
of the time. I mean, for you, what does that do to you?
You know, it's hard because I left before all these collapse, you know, began. And
you left Venezuela over 20 years ago before even Chavez showed up.
Correct. So it's through stories that you learn what it really happens. And through these children who, you know, in a way, like I hear Mylin telling her story at the beginning, she's very protected. All the parents protect them so much. They don't let them see the reality of what's going on there.
Yeah.
They just take them to school, come back to school, and that's it. But when you hear the real stories behind all these children, it's terrifying. You know, it's inhuman for what they're going through. So what happens is, what, like Mylin said, her teacher contacts us. And, you know, I have a student.
Her teacher back in Minnesota.
Ballet teacher.
Yes.
Ballet
yes.
teacher, yeah.
To come to the U.S., do you think? And we said, well, there's a summer program starting right now. And that's when she started. Isn't what, like a week later when she started with us, that I learned that she was living in a hotel with her family. So it was pretty difficult.
First of all, I mean, yeah, Mylin, I mean, so it was your ballet teacher who told you about this school here.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that's how you knew to get to Miami. So you
Correct.
Had this opportunity. Okay, so you arrive. What's it like those first few months? And she said, you guys are living in a hotel.
Yes, I was for probably like a month. The first day that I came in, I actually came in on the 4th of July. Everywhere was like a party, you know? And the next day I started with the summer intensive program. So I was the whole day in the ballet, during the other classes in the intensive. I didn't have like the time to think about it, like what was going on, like what happened. You know, I'm here, I'm not going back. I just like blocked that part of my mind and I just went every day to dance and that's it.
Ruby, when did you start bringing in kids like Mylene? Because again, the problems in Venezuela have been happening for many years, have gotten worse these last couple of years. But you were, to get Mylene, you were going through the ballet teacher in Venezuela. Is that how you're bringing in a lot, finding a lot of these kids? Yes. And helping them? Is the ballet teacher saying, hey, I've got somebody, I need to send them to you?
Many, many of them, yes. Others just come and they know about Vladimir. Vladimir Isayev, who is the director, yes, of the Arts Ballet Theater of Florida and is very well known in Venezuela as a ballet teacher because he worked there at the Teresa Carreño for 10 years. And they know me too because of my father. My father was a very well-known musician in Venezuela, and they know there is a place to come and be safe. That's how I feel.
Do you know over the years how many different kids you've helped?
I was going through the list, let's say the mental list, and with the help of others, because when you do these things, you really don't make up a chart, you know? You just don't write it down.
Right.
You just do it because it comes from the bottom of your heart. And we calculated like 85 in the last kind of 10 years. And right now we have like 20 something in the school, like
is
from
it,
Venezuela.
Is it getting harder? Because as things are getting harder in Venezuela, more kids may want to get out.
It is hard. For some are harder than others. Some have their resources.
Yes.
So they come, they have no problems. The parents have the visa, working visa, so investors. So I don't know. They have different visas, but there are some that are just coming to ask for the asylum.
Right.
And that's when things get really rough. There are people that come, they come to the school, they want to be, you know, taking ballet classes, because the idea is from the parents, for what I hear, is I want her to have the same things she had in Venezuela so she doesn't feel the impact.
Right.
They want to protect them. So what happens is they want to continue ballet. But the problem is that some are in some family member place, and that is probably in Weston or Doral, which is the most common for Venezuela, and we're in North Miami Beach.
Right. I'm speaking with Executive Director Ruby Romero Isayev from the Arts Ballet Theater of Florida and one of her student teachers, Mylene Rodriguez. Both women are from Venezuela, and the company has given many displaced dancers scholarships and opportunities to build a career in dance, to build a life here in South Florida. Mylene, right now, you're waiting for your status to see how things turn out. As you know, the debate in Congress over temporary protected status for Venezuelans, and they're waiting to see if the Senate will vote on it. What's it like for you right now?
It's just, let's say, very frustrating, I guess. You just have to wait. There's no answer for you right now. You just have to wait and see what happens. I have friends that have been here for around 5 up to 8 years, and they still have not get any response. I'm just in my third year, so I'm just waiting to see, hope for the best.
Now, you're about to start college.
Yes.
And you're going to be up in Broward.
Mm-hmm, correct.
Having this situation with your status has been difficult because it also limits what you can do. You actually were going to go off to a college, you got a scholarship, and then what?
And then the last minute they said that they cannot do anything for me because of my status.
I mean, in those moments, how do you get yourself through all this?
Staying in ballet, I guess, teaching, talking with my family, my friends, just not going through it alone, I guess.
Ballet for you, it helped you get here. Where do you want it to take you? Where do you see ballet in your life as you continue?
Right now, I'm trying to start again because I got an injury last year. So I'm going back at it little by little. But I definitely want to keep it in my life forever if I can.
Are you teaching, you said?
Yes, I'm teaching for the little ones, the toddlers, and another level that it's between 2 years old to 3, and the other one is from 3 up to maybe 5 years old.
So you're working actually at the ballet.
Yes.
And this is helping you pay for school.
Yes, correct. Over the next few years, probably I want to keep studying. I want to keep dancing as well. And I just want to keep working hard. I don't want to give up.
Ruby, you know, again, you see kids like this, you see young people going through these struggles. It's got to take a toll on them. The stress of going to school is already difficult. And now you're adding this on top of it. How are you working with them beyond just the dance, working with them to help them with these things?
It really feels very difficult when you hear them and when you see them crying. They're coming from the interview that they got scholarships and then they said, you know what, forget about it. You're on your own. They are considered like an international student. Therefore, their tuition is more expensive. In Mylene's case, she was devastated.
Yeah.
And so we were all devastated because we know she's a good kid. She's a very good student, excellent grades. And then, boom, she's thinking that she's moving on. And no, there's a big stop sign in front of her that she wasn't expecting. So she was already teaching the babies in the school. So it happened that the person that was working at our front desk left. And I said, okay, then now you have a job. Now you're going to make money so you can pay for your college. So happy ending for now while she waits. But we had other case like Claudia Suarez. That is super, super hard because this kid came really, really running away from horror because her father was involved in politics and things and, well, a bunch of stuff. But and they just came like, Mylene, can you take her? And we say, okay, yeah, sure, bring her. So we took her, but then again, they didn't have a place to live. It was only Claudia and her mom, no one else. Claudia, super smart, extremely smart. Yes. She did junior and senior year in 1 year and graduated cum laude. Tons of scholarships.
But the status situation.
Yeah, that was a stop sign. So she continued to dance. So I started to take her because she knows how to write very nicely. So I started to take her to workshops where I was taking like for marketing or for grant writing or for things like that. And she started to learn and now she's a blogger for dance.
Yes.
But, you know, this is the type of things that we try to help a little bit in connection with ballet.
Mylene, do you still follow everything that's going on in Venezuela, or are you trying to distance yourself?
Both, because I try to know what's going on, but at the same time, I cannot understand because things have got so, so much worse since I left. Every time that someone comes new and they tell me, listen, these are the prices, this is what's going on, that doesn't exist anymore. That's the people from that company left, or that store closed, or it's just everyone went through something really, really bad. Well, my family that it's still there, they almost some days they cannot eat. It's not enough, or it's really bad. Actually, it's bad.
Do you think you'll ever see a day where you can go back? Do you want to?
I don't know. Probably I'll want to go. But the thing is that the Venezuela that I knew is not there anymore. The people that I know are not living there. And the people that are still there, we don't know if I'm going to be able to see them again or my family. It's just, I don't know. I never got the chance to, like, know and experience that Venezuela that Ms. Ruby knew. I know a whole different Venezuela that she knows, but the one that I knew is not there anymore. Maybe I'll go back. I want to if things get better again, but it will be to visit. I don't think I'll be able to live there again.
A lot of people are waiting to see what happens.
Yes.
What are your dreams, Mylene? What are your dreams for your life?
As much as I can, I'm going to try to repay my mom and my dad for everything that they have done for me. That's my goal. I want to have enough to give them back all that they have given me.
That's a beautiful dream. Ruby, again, you're going to see many more people like Mylene.
Yes.
Hopefully things change, but how do you view the future?
It's hard because, you know, when you see these things happening, you just go back to the, you know, to your history lessons. And you know what history says, you know, and there are other countries that went through the same thing and they're still in this situation like Cuba. And it's hard to think that, but it's most probably going. And the situation is even worse now because there's so many interventions of other countries and drug and this and that. The stories that we hear from the people that come, it's horrible. And if I could see a future, I would like to see it beautifully, like the way Venezuela was when I left, or half of it, or maybe something. But it's so hard because you don't know people anymore. You don't know who they are anymore. You know, people, things change. Like Mylene said, everybody's gone, and your family's no longer there either. But every time some friends have their parents pass away or something, or their kinses, or, you know, things like that, there's no way to celebrate or to mourn because you don't have it. Everything you do is through a screen.
That was an amazing conversation that we had recently with Ruby Romero Isayev, Executive Director of the Arts Ballet Theater. And you heard from 18-year-old ballet dancer Mylene Rodriguez. And again, Mylene now starting classes this week. And it's really amazing that she shared her story and the struggles and the fact that she may never return to Venezuela, or at least not go back to live there. And I know there are a lot of people here waiting to find out if Congress is going to pass any form of TPS, any kind of protection for Venezuelans trying to escape the crisis back in their home country. And if you find yourself in a situation like Mylene is right now, we'd love to hear from you. Find us on Facebook at WLRN Sundial. You can also email us. We'd love to hear from you because we want to find these stories. Email us sundial at WLRNnews.org. I wish Mylene the best as she moves forward, and hopefully her and her family find some peace and that her dance continues. And again, you can read more of her story and see photos, by the way, go to WLRN.org. Well, that's our program for this Monday, August 19th. Sundial is produced by Chris Remington and Alejandra Martinez. Lily Oppenheimer assisted in producing this week. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Taryn Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. And WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka. The man pushing all the buttons, our technical supervisor, is Peter J. Mertz. Well, coming up tomorrow on Sundial, thousands of families in South Florida are struggling to purchase the basic needs of their daily lives, especially one item, diapers. Diapers aren't covered by food stamps or by the special supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children. And with hurricane season in full swing and the school year well underway, there's a push right now by a local nonprofit to get diapers to the families in need. Plus, there's a new exhibition at the Iris Photo Collective in Little Haiti. It's taking viewers into Cuba. The exhibition is entitled Cuba, Paradise Lost in Nostalgia, and it features award-winning photographers capturing the life and the experiences on the island nation. Miami Herald photographer Carl Joost explains to us the meaning of the Afro-Caribbean swag and, of course, how it led to the hustle that we know is life here in South Florida. Also talking about art exhibits, there's another great one in Key West. It's called The Restless Eye, The Visions of Olga Manosalvas. It's exploring the themes of loss and family through a collection of paintings. They are bold and colorful, and the use of many found objects go into the work by Ecuadorian painter Olga, who has collected over more than 40 years worth of experiences that you can check out there. We talked to her as well about the exhibit. Just a reminder, Sundial is going to be in Key West on Thursday for a live show. It's focused on marine life in South Florida. You're going to hear from marine experts, lawmakers, and advocates about the fight to save the coral reefs and the sea turtles. The event is free. It's open to the public. You can sign up. I'd love to see you there as we perform the show live. Go to WLRN.org to get your tickets and find out more. By the way, I think that morning, they're going to be releasing a sea turtle, and we'll be there as well. That's going to be so cool.
And I just got to remind you guys that we do have a Sundial Book Club where we're reading a book right now for the month of August. We're reading Mostly Dead Things by Kristen Arnett. The book follows the story of Jessa Lynn Marin. She's a taxidermist in Central Florida. You know, we talked to Kristen, the author of the book, last week, and, well, this is how she describes Jess's character.
I was interested in creating a character who's dealing with, obviously, the trajectory of grief and what that looks like over the context of the narrative. But really, I was trying to make a character who's extremely controlling in every kind of aspect of her life. I wanted to write a character who not only wants to control her own emotions and her own sense of self, but also the sense of self and the emotions and the actions of everyone around her.
And that is author Kristen Arnett. Are you reading Mostly Dead Things? We know some of you are because we've heard from our book club members like Anna Viciana Suarez. She said, I loved how she portrayed Florida. Very atmospheric. I was a little depressed at the end, though I'm not sure why, since it's not a sad ending. Shirley Smith Bergman, yesterday I finally got my library copy of Mostly Dead Things. An hour later, I listened to the interview with Kristen. I'm about 80 pages into a quite readable, quirky story. I mean, how often do you read about taxidermy? Arnett's protagonist is carrying around a lot of baggage, and I'm interested in finding out how she deals with it. And tell us what you think of the book. Remember, find us on Facebook. Join at Sundial Book Club on Facebook. It's free. We'd love to have you. Remember, find us at Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.